Hello and welcome to the official Leverage Redemption After Show,
a very distinctive podcast. I'm Felicia Michelle.
I'm Yael Teagle, and today we are talking about the one man's trash job. I'm so excited about this episode.
Reduce, reuse, recycle.
That is correct. Now let's head into the studio to talk about it. Welcome to the official Leverage Redemption After Show,
a very distinctive podcast.
We are talking season 2, episode 2, The One Man's Trash Job.
And that's Yael Teagle and I'm Felicia Michelle.
That's true.
We got very excited.
I'm so excited.
This is a really great episode, though.
This really was. Every time I think about this episode, I'm like, oh, this is an episode about trash. But it's not an episode about trash.
No.
This episode is intricate and complex and deep and gives us beautiful Sophie history.
Don't you just love it? Don't you just love it? Because, like, you're more locked in. One of my favorite things about this episode was actually Elliot Spencer calling. Yeah, he called Sophie out.
This wild guy is not just someone you used to know. Before, when he was on the outside, if you want to pretend that, then that's fine. But he's on the inside now.
Yes.
It's like we all had to talk about what's going on, and now you have to tell us what's happening. Like, you have to let us know what's going on with you.
Absolutely. I feel like, this is the second episode of the season, and we keep getting more of Sophie's secrets and more of her history, which is so beautiful because
Sophie's secrets sounds like a drama or like a, what do you call it? Soap opera.
This is Sophie's Secrets. I mean, that's what we got this season. I'm so loving it, right? We got a complete understanding of a character that we have met multiple times of Charlotte, of her character, her, royal character. And, you know, we last time got to hear a little bit about Kiki. And now, you know, even her old friend Arthur Wilde brings up Kiki and Charlotte, and we get this beautiful history that I have been dying for 6 seasons.
That, and it was really people calling her out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not that, like, oh, I'm like, yeah, call her out, but more like, you know, because it's funny, Arthur says, your grace, your grace.
Your grace. I distinctly recall saying, stay away from Herman.
Almost like you're just a queen and no one thinks you do anything wrong. And he kind of gave that vibe, like, everyone thinks you're spotless, but like, I know that you're not. And redemption is, this is what this leverage is about. It's about redemption. It's about continuing to get better. It's about confronting your past, self-awareness. And now it's like, oh, well, she's not perfect. And that's okay. And it's almost like you love her more because now you see like the imperfections and you know more about like why she's in the position that she's in and how she kind of got to be in that way. And yeah.
Absolutely. I think one of the really great things is that not only does he call her out, but, you know, we have this scene earlier on where Brianna is really determined to help the environment and help the planet and not just this one case. And she says to her, you know, we can't solve the world's bigger problems and we can just take these baby steps. And then that ties in to the beautiful story about her and Arthur and like redeeming herself for what she did to him. Oh my God, this episode is just like synergy.
But don't get it twisted. Like, Arthur is not a spotless man. You know, he is not blameless. He is still running his con and still doing his thing and one of the best to do it. When she saw those papers, though, she was like, I gotta get out of here. I gotta go. And she couldn't get out fast enough, obviously running right into him. I thought it was interesting about his character, though, as you watched the entire episode, is when I first got introduced to him, I was like, why is he telling her his whole con? Like, why would he just lay it all out for her? That's so weird. I don't understand that, especially if she did him dirty at some point in the past. But what I realized after watching the entire episode was that she did what she had to do in the moment and it wasn't the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of knew that she knew that somewhere innately, like she's probably moving in her best interest and it's not malicious towards me. Cause he had some trust for her still. And if you send me to jail, don't ever talk to me. I'm never going to trust you. Don't even look at me.
I agree with you. I spent the whole time.
Also, I can't forge documents, though, so I'm probably not going to go to jail.
I spent the whole episode worrying that he was going to double cross. And then he does, but it's part of the con. And just really this story of who he is and the fact that it's a reminder that our team, they are bad guys, right? They are, yes, they're doing good things, but
sometimes the bad guys are the best good guys.
Right. But I think that it's just a really, you know, because they didn't want to take him down. He's not hurting anybody. Like, not hurting anybody
directly.
He's, he's not hurting anybody who's innocent, right? He is stealing from a bad guy. Yeah, just like they are. And I really, that's what's so great about this show, everybody. That's what's so exciting, is that it's this really complex story about what is right, what is wrong.
And you get educated, too. You know, like, when Harry comes in eating his food, right? Randall was so annoyed. And I find myself kind of being like that, too, because I get a container and I'm like, I don't really know what to do with this. And you don't ever kind of think about how the process of that leaving your lunch that day kind of continues on in the scope of foreverness and whatever that means in our current existence, right? We can argue about that all day, but like just your impact and not really thinking about your impact in more your own comfortability and not looking. And I mean, we start literally, this episode starts with a bang, like an explosion in this woman's boat. Like, that was wild. I didn't expect that.
The way that it's explained as to why she, because it seems so innocuous, like why would we blow up this woman's boat because she's complaining about trash, but really because she's calling out this guy who's stealing antiquities
and is involving the media,
right?
And do a news story. What? No, she didn't get a follow. Well, she got a follow up eventually. I don't know how the house doesn't blow up and that isn't instantly the follow up story, but leave that there. Like, sure.
Look, we don't work in news. You don't work in news anymore.
No, not anymore.
It's not our question to ask. I loved, we had our characters go undercover this episode. We had Elliot go undercover as a corrupt Fed. I love the name drop of McSweden. You know I want McSweden. I know I want him.
I know you do.
I do. But we also got Harry as the Chechen. The introduction, I have to call this out because it was so beautiful. The way he turns around in the chair is the same way that he turned around in the bucket job. And I was expecting another pencil mustache and it wasn't there. And I'm so bummed.
Well, you got the slicked back grease hair, like the T-bird grease hair kind of going on.
The man I work for is very powerful. Powerful enough to solve all of your problems, legal or otherwise, anywhere in the world.
I loved it.
This is a really, really fun episode, too, because it's like, again, like you think, oh, my God, he's now gonna, because you, who can trust a con man? You can't trust a con man, mm-hmm. like, at all. So you don't know, oh, he's really not trying to get, he's like, everything is, and it's funny because he's literally is telling this man the entire thing is fake. He's telling him the honest to goodness truth.
Yeah.
And he still doesn't get it. But I realized that Arthur is not, he is a con man, but he's more like with the documents and stuff. He's mm-hmm. not how our team is. Because when he got shot, he didn't know to fall down.
He was, I'll tell you this.
They're like, fall down.
His con skills, of course he went to jail. His con skills are not great.
No.
Because if you think about it, right? Like, not only does he tell Sophie his whole plan, he lays it out to her and tells her where there's more money. And then he goes and he tells Arthur the whole plan. And he's like, it's a con. Everyone's conning you. I'm like, Arthur tells Clyde the whole thing. He's like, it's a con. They're conning you. I was like, Arthur, shut your mouth. Shut your mouth. I understand that it's part of it, but you don't have to.
She told him, she's like, you were going a little too hard with that.
Yeah. He's not, he's better at forgeries.
One thing, though, even though we got that moment with him, you know, Sophie trying to apologize to Arthur, it was like a big lesson for me, like personally or in real life, was that it doesn't matter. Even if I want to take accountability and I want to have self-awareness or growth or anything like that, whoever that person met however many years ago is who they just dedicated that you are in their mind, and that's it, and you won't be. So sometimes an apology, change behavior, like, you can't control anybody else's thoughts about you, and then you can't let it come down on you, because she was kind of coming down on herself because he kind of was like, no, I'm not forgiving you, and I understand why he wouldn't, but you haven't changed. And that was what he said to her, and I think it seemed like it really hurt her. Like, you haven't changed. It's like, I've done all this work. Like, I lead a group of people that help others. Mm-hmm. How have I not, what do you mean I haven't done the work? I'm not that same person.
I mean, again, it ties into this, these baby steps that she is doing what she has to for herself. And you're right, you cannot control how somebody else is going to respond and react and accept your apology. All you can do is what you can do for yourself.
So there was a line in the show. We don't usually go over lines, but there was one line I really, really liked this episode. And I was like, did anybody else notice this? And I mean, I guess it also is telling of her background story. Parker goes, oh, I've never been to the dentist. I was like, girl, don't say that out loud. Like, don't yell that out in front of a group of people.
Ooh, I've never been to the dentist.
But she's right.
But she was right.
She explains why, and it makes complete sense. And then it makes you think about, has Sophie been to the dentist? Has Hardison? I mean, Hardison probably has, because he changes
it. Is there a dentist to the con artist? Like, there's dentist to the stars. You know, there's, like, dentist to the stars. Like, dentist to the con artist, to the hitmen, to the mob men. Because they have teeth, too.
I'm now thinking a lot about who has and hasn't been to the dentist.
If there's going to be maybe there's going to be an episode of the dentist job. Y'all can have that, I think. Because everyone's scared of the dentist. So I think that's a great villain. It's a small detail that really just says, like, this is a full developed person who has had a weird experience of never going to the dentist.
That's true. I mean, we have this episode which is giving us more about Sophie's background. And we have lots of these little tidbits that we can pick up and put together.
Brianna said, yeah, I went to the dentist. Here's Gina Bellman talking about Sophie's past coming to her present.
Hey, great to see you. Great to be here.
Great to see you. I want to talk about this story specifically because it introduces Arthur Wilde and it introduces really big secrets coming out from Sophie. How was it for you reading the script and learning these things?
You know, this particular storyline and the arc of this season is really special and personal to me. And I think you'll appreciate this because years, right at the conception of the show, we had some like general conversations with the creators, John Rogers and Chris and Dean. And we were sort of like, you know, exchanging ideas about backstories of the characters. And I had this very specific, clear backstory for Sophie that I've just been kind of like sitting on and that we discussed, but that was very much what was kind of in my head of how she started out in her life of crime, what her life was like as a young woman back in the UK, how she got onto that path. And all these years later, I mean, 14 years later, suddenly I get this phone call saying, right, we're doing it. We're doing Sophie's backstory. And we're aligning it with, you know, all those discussions that we had years ago. And, you know, let's run with it. So even though Arthur Wilde wasn't a specific character in my backstory, I definitely always felt that Sophie was someone who, as a sort of young woman, started in a life of crime. I won't give away things that are revealed later in the season, mostly out of mischief and boredom, and that maybe this isn't her first gang, the Leverage aren't maybe her first gang. Maybe she was in a kind of gang before that, and maybe she was sort of in with the aristocracy, and maybe she was like getting up to no good. And then, you know, yeah, this storyline started to come together all these years later, and it was very exciting.
I love that, because if you think about the story of Leverage from the beginning, right, like the whole point was that everyone was a loner who worked alone, and now they came together. And to find out that the reason Sophie was a loner is because she had this other story with this other team, that's amazing.
Yeah, and that she's been on the run from them for so long. She's always, of all the characters, she's the one, you know, through the seasons that has like stopped often and said, what's the collateral damage? You know, who's been exploited in order for me to have this life? And have I exploited children smuggling? Have I been involved in some kind of trafficking? Have I? It's not a surprise that she's suddenly like confronted with these people from her past. And, you know, there's a debt to pay. So when Arthur Wilde shows up and he wants his pound of flesh and he wants his debt to be paid, I think there's been a ticking clock for Sophie kind of waiting for this to happen. But she's evolved so much in terms of like seeing the good in people that she doesn't see that someone might not, you know, she doesn't read the situation perfectly. I mean, actually, you'll have seen in a few episodes this season, she gets it a little wrong. Her radar, her reading is a little bit off this season. I think it's maybe she's overconfident.
I mean, she should be. I mean, she kind of should be overconfident. She's been doing it so well, and her team keeps telling her how great she is, right? Like, her team literally is like, you read somebody's wants from a driver's license. They tell you this all the time. So of course she's overconfident.
But I loved all the moments that I have with, you know, the Elliot character, because he's the person that's always been the one that's gone, hey, what's up? You know, you're not being transparent. You know, we're in this together and you better fess up. And it was nice to have those kind of moments with Christian. You know, we love working together. We love doing all the kind of comedy stuff that we gel so well on. But we also really like to have like an emotional connection. You know, people absolutely love the tap out job that we did years ago, where we had that like real connection. And I think people have maybe been waiting to see that again. And I think they'll see a bit of that between Sophie and Elliot in these episodes.
I love that, because we also kind of see that with Sophie and Harry, in that he, you know, she brings him back to help make sure she course corrects and stays on the path, which is really funny because he's the newest, but they have this like respect for each other.
I think that, you know, Sophie's been a matriarch for the other group for so long. I mean, maybe not so much with Elliot, but she's still really protective of him. And she's still in a state of wanting to make sure, you know, he's okay. And like, she's been the maternal figure in this group for so long that I think when Harry comes along, it's like a relief that she can be on equal footing with a kind of a friend that doesn't know their history and doesn't have those like complicated dynamics. But I think she's also really amused by the fact that she's like, she's read him. She's seen that he liked, you know, Dancing with the Devil. She's seen that he's like dipping his he wants to dip more than his toe in A Life of Crime. And I think in a way she's playing him in a way, although I think she's also kind of liberating him too from a life of kind of toeing the line. But she's definitely enjoying that friendship developing.
We are so excited to be chatting with the writer of this episode, Josh Scher. Check this out.
I'm so excited. Let's talk about this filthy episode. It's dirty and filthy, full of trash. tell me about the process of writing this episode, because it introduces a character that seems important.
Absolutely. We had discussed earlier, you know, right when we started opening the room this year, that we would be introducing a character who was going to get woven through several episodes, and it was going to probably not be introduced in the first episode, but more than likely introduced in this one. And yet we didn't have a plot for it. And I had been doing a lot of reading and hearing so much news, of course, about the environment. And there was this sort of topic that I was really interested in writing about, which was sort of an environmental crime type thing. Spies and an entire sort of new segment of the spy world was getting involved in environmental espionage, and some of it was corporate and some of it was international. And I was just like, I brought it into the room, and Kate was like, it's really interesting. How does it gel with introducing Arthur Wilde? Well, he wasn't even named Arthur Wilde at the time, but you know, we had that character, and it was like, I don't know. Give me a little while. And we, you know, she's amazing. We were allowed to, I mean, I probably threw out four different possible plots that she was like, no, that's probably not going to be it. And until we landed on this version of the story. And you know, the great thing about this season was we finally get to really unpack Sophie and her past. And this was not the beginning of it, it was sort of like step 1B of the process of really getting into her. And we thought that this character would, you know, in Arthur Wilde would really bring it out. The idea of her being a forgery in and of herself was very interesting to us. And we played with that and what we started with a very simple structure, which was, you know, this character who was above everything back way back when is more of a Fagin character, and we had our Artful Dodger character who was Arthur Wilde, introduced in this episode, and you know, Sophie was Oliver. And we started to talk about that and play with that, and it just sort of found its way into this story. And Arthur was part figment of my imagination, because we not the character itself, but what he sounded like, what he did for a living, where he sort of came from, because we talked about what he meant to the story overall, but we had to figure out how he was going to make create a complication for us in this episode. And that was, you know, a lot of that had to do with what plot we landed on for this one.
You said he originally wasn't named Arthur Wilde. Did he have a name before?
We called him the Artful Dodger, if I recall correctly, in the room. There may have been a temp name for him. But I remember I think I came up with Arthur Wilde for the story area, for the two-pager. And it was just, you know, this is an important character to the show. It's an important character to the series. And I really put some extra thought into coming up with a name, and it seemed to work for everybody.
How much flexibility did you have with creating the actual story of their past relationship?
Well, that was something that was discussed at length in the room, and who he is, and who he was to Sophie, and what they did together in the past, and how it all fell apart. Many decades ago, several decades ago, that was poured over again and again. And every draft, it went from, you know, it went from way too long to shorter to more specific to, you know, and then we'll, you know, we had to change it very slightly to fit some other future story that we had come up with. You know, it's when you're doing serialized stuff in an episodic show, things do change.
Yeah.
As everything develops, and this was no different. But so the speech that Sophie gives about who Arthur is when she finally comes clean was really, you know, it was Kate and myself and whoever else weighed in on how they wanted Sophie to sound in that moment, and how they wanted her to sound, you know, three decades ago. And what she did and what she didn't do, you know, it was poured over. And I think it came out great in the end.
Yeah. We get to see Arthur participate with the team in the con in this one. We get to see him have a death scene that he almost completely botches. Tell me about writing the humor in this.
Fall down, you idiot.
I think a lot of the humor came from the fact that Arthur is not as good as Sophie.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur knows it in many respects. He wants to feel, he wants Sophie to think he's done all right for himself. I think that's just ego talking. And he wants to think in some respects that he's at her level, but deep down he knows that he's not. And he's sort of carved out this, this con for himself and this life for himself, and he's pretty proud of that and very protective of it, obviously. And Sophie has to convince him to go for the larger play, but he is not at her level, and we see that come out in many different ways.
Yeah. Speaking of death scenes, we also have Harry gets to have a death scene. I feel like this beautiful shenanigans that happened on the dock there was so fun. How much of that was in the script, and how much was that had to be just decided in the moment on the location?
God, I want to say that 100% of it was written beforehand, and then I want to say 100% of it was figured out on the day. It really did seem like that. We spent so much time working out the specifics of the maze and who would be where and how it would all come out, and that was all on the page. But then, you know, that's just a blueprint, and we got there on the day, and of course you're shooting with far fewer of the shipping containers than it looks like on screen, because we did a lot of visual effects to mm-hmm. extend the container maze. But we had to figure out how it would play without any of that stuff and just make it dramatic and make it fun and make it, you know, make have the energy come through. So there was a lot of like, well, God, can we shave out this line of dialogue? Because it really seems hackneyed if they're running and they're saying it as they're going, because we got to connect this to that. And the geometry of it, well beyond my capacities. But thankfully, you know, we have Mark Roskin and a cast of hundreds and a wonderful crew. And they made it work. It looks great.
Yeah. I mean, the scene with Parker running across the top of the containers, written on the page. I saw it in the script.
Saw it in the script.
And then got to see it on the screen.
Not only written on the page in the script, it was written in the two-pager, I'm pretty sure. If not, it was definitely in the outline. And because I remember Kate reading and you know, she puts comments next to everything as she's helping shape things. And I think her comment was, love this. It'll be sad when it's the first thing cut. Because it was like, how are you going to shoot this? And it was interesting because, you know, you want to see Parker do Parker things. Every episode, you can find a thing for Parker to do in the environment in which you set the episode. That's a huge win. And this was for me, it just felt like the perfect sort of, we didn't have to make a meal of it. You got to see Parker be very graceful and very comfortable in any environment, especially where one is, you know, where things are being lifted with cranes and hooks and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And she doesn't have to, you know, measure or think. She's very natural and organic in that environment. And I felt, we got to do this. Like, this is great.
We sat down with everyone's favorite new hacker, aka like their little baby sis, Brianna, better known as Elise Shannon, and let's hear what she had to say. So talk to us about Brianna's journey from season 1 into season 2.
Brianna could be wrapped up in being like, who, what, where, when, and why am I here? Season 1, she had a lot to learn. She was trying to be a part of a team and biting off a little more than she could chew sometimes, didn't know her left from her right, but I think now she's more seasoned. She has a couple tricks up her sleeve. She's finding that she has assets to the team that the team wouldn't have otherwise. So she's coming in, she's teaching people a little something about Gen Z and millennial culture and new technology and stuff like that. So that was my arc of season 1.
So Brianna's a really special character in the show because there's so much intersection in this character, right? Gen Z, the fact that she's queer, being Black, being a nerd, a blurred. What has the response been from fans and seeing that representation of Brianna on the show?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, there's a lot of people that watch Leverage or Leverage Redemption, and there's a little bit for everybody, you know, like the Christian Kanes of the world, the Sophie Devereaux's. Parker obviously has her own world of kooky and crazy. But yeah, Brianna's intersecting on this spot where a lot of people's kids are, you know, like, hey, you know, mom, dad, I feel this way too, you know, with the intersection of queer and just STEM technology. But I think she's a conversation starter for the multi-generational audience that is Leverage Redemption.
So it's funny you brought up Aldis in the beginning of the interview when you came in, because I asked him about you and he had nothing but amazing, amazing things to say about you. It's quite clear that it's like art and life are imitating each other, because Hardison and Brianna are, you know, brother and little sister. And it seems like he really looks at you like that and kind of has taken you under his wing. Can you talk to me more about, you know, that special bond and relationship that you guys have?
Absolutely. I mean, I think Aldis is one of the most intelligent, funniest, versatile actors probably of his time in our time walking. He has so much left to accomplish, and I admire him so much. But one of the nicest things that he has done that he literally did not have to do was he came and made sure that his presence and my presence made it on a screen together. He made sure that we were in a frame together. And as an actor that's coming into something that I didn't start, it's literally the most gracious thing. He almost had to go out of his inconvenience himself to be that generous. So, I mean, it flatters me that he speaks so highly of me, but yeah, I think highly of him. And then when we cut out all the big words and everything, the dude's just funny. I mean, like, we crack up in the trailer. I'm his shadow when he's on set, you know, and mostly it has to do with like,
what shoes are you, why are you wearing them shoes with them socks? Like, boy, what's going on? What are those? Like, oh yeah, big head, you look like an ant. You know what I mean? It's just fun. He has that spirit that reminds me of home. And I mean, it's flattering if he says the same. If flattering is the least that I could say about it. But just a generous guy, a funny guy, and somebody to look up to. I mean, his body of work is already incredible.
It's funny that you bring up shoes because I asked him, I'm not trying to start any trouble, but I asked him and he said he has a better sneaker collection than you. And I know you're a sneakerhead, so I'm just going to give you some time to respond to his claim that he is the bigger sneakerhead than you.
I'll tell you a 30-second story about Aldis's shoe choices. Aldis does have a lot of sneakers that I want in my life. However, there was one day where Aldis was being nice and a couple castmates, we all went out, and some people from costumes, we went out, and Aldis was wearing a pair of what I can only describe as clogs. And I was shook and I was a little upset. All in all, he looked a little bit like Pinocchio. So then I had to, what are those? The Geppetto ones? What are those? I'm a real boy looking ass. Like, what? Like, but I don't want to embarrass you, Aldis Hodge. I'll just say that one pair of shoes I will still disagree with every single time. But his shoe collection is probably better than mine.
We sat down with the director of this episode, Mark Roskin.
I am sitting down with director Mark Roskin. Hello, I'm so excited. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic. I want to talk about the one man's trash job. This episode had so much going on and really like starts off the journey for the season. Tell me what it was like diving into this episode.
All of our episodes are ambitious, but this one was fun to do. It was also something exciting to do with the explosion. And we got to put our heroes up against a truly evil, despicable person. You know, whenever you're filming around water, that raises the stakes as well. But we also introduced one of our villains for the show.
Yeah. Tell me about shooting around water. How does that affect things?
Well, it's always things are a little slower. You always have to take safety into precaution, you know, and make sure everybody's safe. But it always looks pretty, but it always takes a little longer.
Tell me about making the like dirty water, right? Because it was full of trash, and I assume you all didn't just like let's litter.
No, that was all done by our fabulous visual effects department. So what you see, the trash in the foreground, that was actual trash. And then we just put CG trash in to take over the background.
The episode ends with our villain opening a container and like trash comes out. How did you get the trash to like fall out?
Our special effects team led by our Ty Abramson was able to build a rig that as the doors open, it was kind of like a push rig that just pushed all the trash out.
That's amazing. So it wasn't like a person sitting back there just pushing.
No, just whipping trash. No. But, you know, it was probably considered.
I mean, that sounds like really fun. It's just that your job is to sit there and throw trash at somebody.
No matter how much we clean up, there's always more.
One man's trash is this woman's treasure. Here is Kate Rourke with more about this episode.
We've got issues about pollution and how it affects the climate and the world that we live in. And then you've also got Sophie's backstory starting to be introduced to us. We meet Arthur Wilde. What was the humor that we threw onto that one?
Well, basically, we had a lot of fun with Brianna sort of like making fun of Harry for using trash, and also Parker just running around the dockyard, flying over things on a crane and with ridiculous Irish accents, and she was just having a ball doing all that stuff.
Yeah, that's some of my favorite stuff is Parker's ridiculousness. Just like her shenanigans are so fun.
As you know, Leverage Redemption deals with some really serious and heavy issues, but it's not always serious and heavy on set. Let's see what it's like when the cameras aren't rolling.
And this is where the magic happens.
This is a new Leverage headquarters, and we've got a lot of new stuff that no one's ever seen. Right here's where we keep our A-list actors. So this is Aldous Hodge right here.
Aldous right here.
You guys know him as Hardison. Yep.
We've got Gina Bellman. Gina
right here. Hello.
Over here. And a brand new addition, Elise Shannon.
Yay!
Hey.
What's
this
up,
the
people?
Bar right over here is where all the good stuff happens, like getting drunk and talking about cons. And, you
this
know,
is
right
where we spend
you.
A lot of our time, and we try to make sure this doesn't happen.
Stage!
Where she gives that performance, and this is Hardison and Brianna's stage where they give their presentations.
And this is our hardworking crew, the Leverage crew.
This is our lovely second team who are basically us. This is Gabby, who is Sophie.
This is Jazz.
Catherine. We've got.
Hey.
And Jazz.
As you can see in the background, the punching bag, that's Elliot's, the character's favorite space, but it's obviously Christian's favorite space too. But we're about to take y'all upstairs real quick to show you the rest of the set that our amazing art crew designed, built, decked out. They got us good. Let's go.
So upstairs, we got our big swimming pool and like a helicopter pad. We got like a funny farm room and like the little roller coasters from Grease and stuff. Y'all can't see it, but trust me, it's there. Maybe next time. Maybe next time. Yeah, I'm lying.
Check out the attention to detail.
Hardison built Parker a zip line that we've yet to see. It's coming though, right?
You gotta imagine it. But now this space is awesome. I mean, of course it doubles as a second set piece, but we get to get awesome camera angles from our crew. Looking down, take a gander.
I drop water balloons on people's head from up here. Not that we'd ever do that, no. VIPs only. You can't come in here. I'm sorry. You know, private. There's no Aldous.
Excuse me, I gotta use
no
the bathroom real quick.
No,
I gotta use the bathroom.
No.
It's my turn.
We tried to keep everything New Orleans and put it in here and really represent the city that we're filming in. So it's been a lot of fun for us. There's a lot of down home. It's just New Orleans vibe in here, especially with music, when it comes to food. This whole place is based on that. And our set deck guy, Randall, did a hell of a job with that.
Here's even more from writer Josh Scher. So you mentioned the outline, the two-pager. Explain this for those of us who are not writers. What is the process of idea to shooting?
Idea? You bring it in and, you know, you let the room help shape it. And on this one, they absolutely did. Again, I came in with a world and a lot of research and specifics, but no idea for the story. We shaped it in the room. When Kate felt like we finally had it, I went off and I wrote a two-pager. And
what is a two-pager?
Two-pager is the story area where you're really telling the emotional arc of the story and introducing the world and the premise and the plot, and you're trying to fit it into an area that is sort of bite-sized enough where it lets you know if you have too much or too little, and if the story flow is there, and if the emotional beats take place, because it's really, you can read it in one, you know, sort of one bite. And they're really valuable for that. Once those get tweaked and sent off to Amazon, and Freevee, then you go and you write the outline. And the outline is, for me, it's where most of the writing takes place. You figure out how every scene will work, what the conflict is in every scene, what the levity is in each scene, or definitely what the emotional arcs carry through, and, of course, how the plot materializes in what will be every scene in the script when it's ready to go. And then that gets poured over, and there's a lot of thought that goes into that, and you can pretty much tell when you have too much story in an outline. And then you go to the script. And the script is, you know, hopefully with the, after the outline, a tremendous amount of the work is done. And then it's just putting it on its feet and making sure that it fits into the amount of pages that you have. And, you know, after your first, we call it a vomit draft, you realize I way overwrote this. And there's no, you know, my first act is 10 pages too long, and it's really only supposed to be 12 pages in the first place. So you're in trouble. And then you just start picking and choosing what the choicest moments are and what tells the story and how to fold one thing on top of another and get it down to the length that you need it to be. It's not easy, but it's the challenge and it's the fun.
And then it gets rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. And
you start rewriting immediately based on things like, well, there's no way we can produce this set piece, or we don't have this location, or, you know, it's one of those things where you can never say where the problem is going to come from, or let's just call it the issue is going to come from, that makes you rewrite. In this one, we had our trusty consulting producer and co-creator of the series, John Rogers, telling us while we were breaking the story, shipping containers are your friend. You'll never have a problem shooting shipping containers. You can situate them anywhere you want. They're always easy to get. They're cheap. It's going to be no problem at all. Do the shipping container bit. And it's like, we get to production, and even in prep, it was like, look, there's a supply chain problem in the entire world right now. We are having a tremendous problem finding shipping containers. Looks like we can get about 10 of them. And it's like, we're supposed to have a shipping container maze. And then you can, you know, you start the rewriting from there. And, you know, in the end, it was like we thought we might be able to get about 30 to 50 shipping containers. I think that got whittled down. Mark Franco came in with, you know, great visual effects, and you make do with what you can. But rewriting happens because you might not be able to produce things. And then rewriting happens because the story needs shaping, and my stories always need a lot of shaping. Sometimes I write on a cinematic scale, and you have to bring it down to, you know, what's possible in the TV world, and what you can, you know, squeeze into 42 to 45 minutes of television. So yeah, rewriting, it's a big part of it.
I want to ask about the trash, because we have water filled with trash. We have containers that open and trash comes falling out. Tell me, how did we go to a recycling plant and collect, or did everyone just bring stuff from home? Or?
That's a really good question. It definitely, you know, the people on set who are phenomenal at what they do, they put some things together where it felt like it was all tied together with, it was either glued together or it was tied together. So these were sort of flotillas of trash in the water, which is really interesting. They could be moved around with a stick, and, you know, you move one piece and the whole thing goes. And then from what I understand, there's going to be a lot more visual effects of trash that goes beyond just the stuff that's sort of right in the foreground when it's all said and done. But the trash, yeah, I don't know where they got it all from. I remember asking our showrunner, Kate Rorick, early on, once I was doing all this research on recyclability and the lie that is being shared by the corporations that produce this stuff, saying, oh, no, it's recyclable, when really it's not very easy to recycle most of the plastics. It's getting a little bit easier now with certain regulations, but, you know, historically speaking, a lot of recycling has been a story that is being told to us that we are believing, and because we want to believe it, and it's not necessarily the case. So I asked Kate early on, it's like, can we try to make a pledge where, like, every piece of plastic that we use in this episode can be recyclable, and we can sort of wear that badge proudly? And she's like, sure, let me see what I can do. Never heard back, but I'd like to believe that everything we use in this episode was recyclable.
including Harry's container that he felt terrible about?
That I don't
about?
Know. I, Noah might still have that at his house. I don't know. It's a prop from the show. He likes to keep these things.
Sure, sure. You know, people like to steal props from shows. Absolutely. So he took that one. That's the one to take. This episode is so fun, and we get to see almost all of our characters, and we get to introduce these backstories and really progress that. And there's really just this beautiful story about helping the world and what can we do by helping one person mm-hmm. to help the world, which is a theme that we address a lot on this show. Tell me about writing thematically in this show.
Well, we before we even started talking about story this year, in terms of episode after episode, we were talking about the main character arcs for the season. And we do talk a lot about that sort of thing on the series, but with Brianna still being, relatively new to the show, but young in terms of the show's cast and young in terms of the show's characters, she needs to learn that. Or we want her to learn it. We don't want her to learn it quickly. We want her to learn it slowly. And she's such an interesting character. She's got such an interesting backstory that we felt like she probably wouldn't be bringing this in. She wouldn't know it when she arrives. She would want to change things faster on a larger scale. The world that, you know, many people of my generation have left for the or have created and will ultimately leave for the generations behind us is right now not the best. And we don't seem to be doing many things to fix it. And a lot of the small scale stuff isn't working. So it makes perfect sense to me. It made perfect sense to everybody in the room that Brianna would have grander designs on how to change things. We joke, and this is not something that she would ever do, but she's, you know, she would like to throw the Molotov cocktail. You know, she wants to do the car bombing, and, you know, that would take care of things a lot faster, but it's inelegant and there's collateral damage, which is something that Sophie introduces in this episode and will be a rolling theme. When I say rolling, I mean a snowball rolling downhill and getting bigger and bigger as the season continues. But that is where we started. Brianna's arc of learning that you really have to take small steps and having these grander designs is good in theory, but not great in practice. That'll come up later in the season as well.
Just like our crew, the fans of Leverage Redemption are so talented. So check out some of the fan art that we received this season.
The official Leverage Redemption After Show is part of the Electric Surge Network on Electric Now. We recommend checking out some of our other original content, like Inglourious Trexperts, and even more official aftershows for Electric Entertainment properties. Thank you so much for joining us here talking about episode 2 of Leverage Redemption season 2. I cannot believe it. We still have so much more, like the specials that we put out before this season. And of course,
social media. So hey, head over, follow us at After Leverage. We know that you want more. Leave comments, send us pictures. We love all that stuff. We love talking about the show because it's obviously the best show right now. Hello. That's why I got a season 2.
Absolutely.
Right.
Until next time, I'm Yael Teagle.
I'm Felicia Michelle.
And this has been a very distinctive podcast.